When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session. Welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua. Oh my gosh. It's been a time.
Yes, it has been a time. What's new, C-Cat?
Whoa. What is new?
You know, the length of your hair right now, I bet you could comb it into a nice little pussycat wig looking thing.
Yeah, I really need this cold weather, which again, it's a Southern California cold weather, but this cold weather has really made me not want to do it.
Fuck you right in the face.
I really wish. So when COVID was like at its peak in 2020, mm-hmm. I bought one of those at home kits to do haircuts and stuff.
Always a good idea.
Always a good idea. I just wanted to shave my head. My mom really was against it, which it says interesting things about like bodily autonomy because it's. But I wish that I like learned how to clean up the like sides and the sideburns and the ears and stuff, because the length I'm in love with, like I really love this like beautiful long hair, but I wish I could just clean it up so that way I didn't look so ragged. But
you don't look ragged. I was just saying it could be.
I feel that way. Lately when the hair gets long like this, I start to feel like I need to go visit the barber, which I do love my barber, so I'm not trying to replace them or save any money by giving myself haircuts. I really like the job they do, but I just wish I could like trim it up when I in between visits. I don't have that problem. You have luscious long hair.
I still have to get it trimmed, but yeah, I don't worry about the once you get it past a certain length, it doesn't look so awkward. So you could just keep going and just let it grow. Actually, I wonder, what would you look like with a bob or like a bowl cut? Because it goes like that for a while with your hair. Growing mine long, there were definitely some periods where it was like, what? Maybe I should just cut it all off. But because it just looks so weird, especially when it was like here at like my, can you imagine my hair just right here?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Because it had to grow.
This very severe symmetrical bob. Yeah. I feel like for me, I would look like Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men.
That's you could try before maybe in this next year coming up.
Maybe.
What else has been going on?
I've started watching some new TV, which has been great because I've reached a point where my comfort watches, I have finished. You know, I did Frasier.
Oh, so what you're saying is the watch analytics or the ratings or whatever for the Gilmore Girls have crashed and burned on.
Yes. Yes. I'm I love you. I actually am starting to watch the Gilmore Girls right now.
From the beginning?
Not from the beginning.
Oh, that's right. You don't like, you said the first season or two.
God, I hate like season rewatch. One. Season one pisses me off so much. Season two is fine. Season three, I will start.
No, that's okay.
With,
like, we've had the conversation before. It's okay. What's the new stuff you're watching?
I recently finished Mr. and Mrs. Smith on Amazon Prime, and I just started watching, and it came out a couple years ago, but I just started watching Welcome to Chippendales. I'm not in love with it at the moment, but the podcast that was on Spotify for a long time, which was What's Your Fantasy, which was about the Chippendale story and the murder and Steve Banerjee and Nick DeNoia, was so good. That podcast was like one of my favorite things that came out that year. I have a lot of high expectations for the show, and I'm trying to stick through it because I'm curious how they're going to make it to the end of this 8 episodes. But it's got Juliette Lewis, and she just showed up. Anna Lee Ashford, it just showed up in the show. It's got Murray Bartlett.
All right.
Playing a homosexual.
Okay.
We'll see how it goes. What are you watching?
We've been watching. We have our Wednesday group back up and running after an extended break. Move Lily over there. So we've been watching the Capote versus the Swans, the new feud, the new season of Feud, which is so odd because the first one came out 7 years ago, which is mind blowing to me.
I also am watching Capote versus the Swans, but not with you, because I dislike you, but separately.
I don't care.
Yeah, I was going to say you don't care. I'm not going to justify it. That's more for
you are missing out on excellent commentary and filling in the gaps of historical information I have if you're not watching it with us. But
because I remember when the first season of Feud came out 7 years ago, we did a whole day where we watched What Happened to Baby Jane. We watched Mommy Dearest. There was a little documentary thing that we watched, and I feel like I'm losing that with Capote versus the Swans.
Yeah, but, it's such a specific time period.
Yes. What do you think about it? What's the feeling of it all?
I'm enjoying it so far. We've only seen the first 2 episodes. It's mean. It's catty, which was very much in the spirit of Capote, of Truman Capote, who was also a bit of a catty lady.
A catty wumpus.
Shady boots the house down, I think is what the kids might call her these days. Yeah, I'm enjoying that. And I've been reading Answered Prayers, the book that he was writing during this time that was published after his death. I had read the book that this series is based on, Capote's Women. That was really a good read. So yeah, it's fascinating. And it's interesting to watch with people who have been coming that are also part of like book clubs and stuff I'm in. So it's like about a writer. So it's just been fun talking about that. And somebody who is in Truman Capote, this very famous author, well-regarded with like In Cold Blood and such, who was also out, which was unheard of at that time period. So it's just fun to watch things that are like about writing or about the making of literature or books, something that, you know, a lot of us love.
Yeah.
But I'm enjoying also, it. And the clothes.
Oh, yes. And the clothing. He himself was such a flawed person. And I'm curious with book club people, and I say this as people who read books, but are not maybe connected to that creative process of writing. Because you are a creative person. You create music. You write your own. You write stuff. So you're more connected to it than, let's say, a layperson that is in a book club that reads like 200 books a year or whatever. But I'm curious if there's been any conversation about how messy he was as a person and the cachet that he had being a writer, raconteur, and this gadfly on these high society ladies, their professional gay best friend.
Yeah, there's like that whole glamorizing of like pills and booze and smoking and this kind of whole world. When you think of a lot of those kinds of writers, it's almost a cliche, but maybe he created the cliche.
Tom Holland is doing a really good job. I lose Tom Holland entirely.
Yeah, totally. We were talking about that. They looked up pictures of him and they were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is him. Yeah, he's totally lost in it. But yeah, I really enjoy the look of it, the clothing of it all. I am looking forward to seeing how because the big question is still why? Mm-hmm. Why he did it? Why he betrayed all these women? And when he'd worked so hard to get into that life and get into those circles from the time he was a kid, when his mother also tried. So it's like, why did you got to the pinnacle where it's like he could have hosted the rest of his life with those women, being their friend and confidant and, you know, supporting them in ways that, like, obviously their husbands weren't or their children weren't or, you know, their own parents or whatever. And he like blew it all up. And that's the question. It's like, why? So I'm curious to see how this will answer that. Because I don't think even the book that I read and stuff, it was just like, I mean, there was like a real contempt for that world. Mm-hmm. But he also really wanted to be part of it. So it's fascinating. So I'm curious to see where it wraps up.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we're watching that. We're watching the True Detective, Night Country. I'm enjoying that with Jodie Foster. And then the Sam Squanch and I have just started where we've watched two episodes so far of The New Look on Apple TV Plus or whatever the hell it's called. Apple
yes, Plus. Benm as Christian Dior.
Yes, as Christian Dior. And more to the point, Julia Binoche as Coco Chanel. Yes. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to watch. You know, one, because I don't think that story, that's another thing where it's like, I don't think a lot of people know this story or know like Coco Chanel's involvement with the Nazis. I mean, you know, she gets like wrapped up in, you know, because you go, oh, Hugo Boss and Chanel and, you know, all these different people, you know, cars and things, all the different things that were made by and for the Nazis that still exist today, that still survive. And, but it's interesting to see the, at least this particular story's version of those events. So it's a lot of, God, is that true? I didn't know that. Or, and like with Jeffrey too, because he loves that time period.
Yeah.
It's fun kind of filling in gaps of stuff. Although apparently they made a mistake because they've been calling Winston Churchill Sir Winston and he wasn't, it's in the 40s and he wasn't a sir yet.
So, oh, interesting.
But that was coming from him. I didn't fact check it either way because I care.
The trailer is painting it as post, what do we do post-war? Because I don't feel we, I don't feel we talk enough or I, at least in my experience, it's like I've not found really anything that's interesting that deals with the immediate repercussions of World War II in media and such. As I say that, there's probably five things that, you know, could come to mind. But I love it from this very European standpoint, right? And especially the culture and what is the point and how do you re-energize an industry that in the face of war was meaningless, right? Or not meaningless, but like frivolous.
Right. Yeah. And that's part of it because Christian Dior was working with Lalonde, who was making dresses for Nazi members' wives and other people. And again, the uniform, that it was such an important part of the way that the Nazis looked. Fashion, they really were aware of PR. It's like of looking a certain way. So, yeah.
Perception,
but and it's, yeah, it's going, it's both ways because it's like starting. I mean, I guess really the last episode we watched was kind of all set in the past. So it is, it's trying to tell two stories because it's trying to let you in on what happened with Christian Dior, like why, what he was doing during the war, what Chanel was doing, and then the immediate aftermath and how he went to build his first collection that included that, the New Look dress that he gets cited with creating this modern silhouette for women. So that's part of the story is like, how did he get, how did he make and build his own fashion house? But it's also a lot about, how the Nazis were operating in France and the different kinds of things that they were trying to do. Yeah, I think you should watch it. I bet you'd enjoy it. And again, there's lots of really beautiful clothes.
I want to go back to how Feud was 7 years ago. Have you read anything as to like why it took this long?
Because they... season? Yeah, because they were doing different things. Like first they were going to do something on Charles and Diana and then The Crown stole that thunder. They were going to do something on Hurricane Katrina. I don't know why that didn't happen.
Katrina versus New Orleans is the feud or what?
I just remember that being part of the early conversation.
Okay.
Or maybe that was Crime Story. I don't know. They just had a whole bunch of different stories and either somebody else came along and told it or they worried, hey, the Crown's going to cover that. So, are we going to do it better than them?
Yeah. Especially because that Diana movie with Kristen Stewart came out too. So
it's all
pointless. Yeah. Oversaturated.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's exactly the right thing for Ryan Murphy's Feud. I think that they have to find things that are like campy.
Yeah.
I don't know if they even... The American Crime Story was pretty good, the OJ one, and that was a pretty serious approach. It's just sometimes it's hard to take Ryan Murphy too serious. And I don't really want to. I want his stuff to have a camp factor, to have a queer vibe to it.
Yeah.
So like the Capote show makes a lot of sense. I think it's risky because so many people probably are like, what the heck? I don't even know what this story is. But it's really fascinating because, again, the world has changed in many ways, but it hasn't. And so that's why it's nice to highlight the way that we look at like the rich and the powerful as beacons of, you know, or what am I trying to say? It's like we find it fascinating when the rich and powerful are like tabloid fodder, right? We love to build up our people to tear them down. And these women were like the original influencers. There's a comment about people don't come here to this restaurant for the food or whatever, or for the restaurant. They come here because we come here. And so they're like style and tastemakers who have all this drama going on. And then, and again, this is still very relevant to our world and very relevant to the influencer culture and celebrity culture. And with Feud, obviously, it was about, like, of course, the relationship between Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. But it still told a very contemporary story about women in film that we still see. Women in celebrity culture in general. Wow, it's still, there's always got to be people like, don't you hate that other person? What do you think of her? What are you always trying to get women to tear each other down and make us all complicit in that?
So
I think if they keep doing it, they just have to find something that kind of can ride that line of campy fun, but has some serious elements. But yeah, I just want it to be fun. The Crown isn't, I don't think it's fun. And I also don't think taking Charles and Diana's feud and putting it through like the Ryan Murphy lens with the camp factor would be a good idea.
Especially because The Crown with Charles and Diana, there was like an episode in the last season where they healed them. They retconned a healing moment between the two of them right before that fateful summer where she takes the kids and he's just like, what if we just try to be the best co-parents as possible, which makes me wonder to what extent the creators of The Crown were in contact, how much contact they had with Charles, just because the later seasons of The Crown, Charles ends up getting a nicer narrative than the earlier seasons, or at least the first season with Diana. I'm so curious as to what's going to happen, because I feel like we're just a couple years removed from like Feud, Kanye versus Taylor Swift, which would be like and that's the thing, is that even that show wouldn't even be about the two of them. It would be about everything around the two of them, which is what I felt was really effective with the first Feud, is that they talked a lot about each individual woman to inform the hatred that they had for each other, and ultimately showing a lot of similarities that they had with each other too.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day, but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come, baby, come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast.
All right, welcome back. So today we are wrapping up our Salute to Black Horror 2024. Although, again, this won't be the last of Black Horror on the show, of course, but just to give it a proper. And today we're talking about The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster, 2023 sci-fi horror picture. Mm-hmm. Now that we spent the whole first half talking about Feud, I'm going to have to talk. I'm going to have to become Betty Davis. We're going to make this. We got Jay Story on writing and direction. I read that it took a long time, that he wrote this back in 2008 or something, 7-8, and it kept getting rejected and rejected.
And so then in 2020,
finally here.
Yeah,
exactly. We've got Lea de Leon Hayes as Vicaria, stepping in for Victor Frankenstein. Denzel Whitaker as Kengo, Chad L. Coleman as Donald, Edom Atsuswanzi as Chris / the creature, the monster, the titular. Yeah, in a nutshell, this is a Frankenstein story about Vicaria. I almost said it wrong, but she corrects us very clearly in the film, Vicaria. Vicaria, she's a 17-year-old high school student, but brilliant, future STEM leader, especially if she really
women in STEM.
Yes, women in STEM, black women in STEM. Because like women in STEM is its own like percentage, but black women in STEM is even. But yeah, so she's lost her mother to violence, her brother to gang violence. She's seeing her neighborhood just be rife. That's the word, rife with violence. And she decides that death is something that she wants to cure. It's a disease that must be cured. And so she puts together, hobbles together a nice little machine here and resurrects her dead brother. But oh no, as often happens, he's now an uncontrollable rage machine killing left and right. What are we going to do? So
how could we have predicted this?
Who could have foresaw this? Yeah, so that's what the film is about. Joe, what did you think about The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster?
I love the first half. I got lost in the second half.
Okay.
But overall, it was a enjoyable experience, and I would watch this again. This is one of those that like I would show people. Like I would show them, this is a group screening type of movie for me. But overall, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was, I just kept having this thought where when Vicaria talks about death as being a disease that can be cured, that can be conquered, I was trying to remember back to the original Frank movie to see if he was talking, if he talked the same talk about it, because the way that she speaks so confidently about death being a disease reminded me of the musical Jekyll and Hyde. Because the whole in the musical Jekyll and Hyde, and I don't know if this is it true in the book, but in the musical, the reason why he's doing all of these experiments and leads to him creating the elixir that releases Hyde is as a way to cure death. And it could be just a very Victorian Gothic fascination with death. And as are with most things of that type that are in that genre, is it's all about death and darkness and man creating things over science, man versus nature. But it was just interesting to see a young black girl just really ride hard for death as a disease and disturbing the white Karen that teaches her science class, which I, as disturbing as the scene that was, I was just living for her getting real angry with her.
Yeah. Some of the reviews I read about this talked about, it's obviously making a lot of comments, but doing it in a way that felt like it wasn't. And again, I'm here and there. I don't mind heavy handedness at all. I'm not against a film or a work of art making its point bluntly or subtly. But this did use a lot of like real world things that were blended in without having to comment. It's like we now unfortunately have this language, this visual language, because we've just seen it so much in social media and police body cam stuff that the movie doesn't even have to really make a comment, because it's like, I don't need to convince you that this is a reality of my life. You know it. Already know it. Especially the classroom scene, the security guard comes in, throws her out of the chair and on the ground, breaks her glasses, which stay broke the rest of the film, which is actually interesting. One of the things I read was about the subtlety of her own warped vision. Not subtlety, but a symbology, semiotic of her warped vision. And there are other scenes like that. For instance, I don't think it's an accident that Chris, when he's resurrected, the whole film, he wears like a hoodie over him. And it made me, sorry, over there on Patreon, you can see this, but I pulled this book that I read in undergrad, Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine. And it has like the hoodie sort. It's was inspired a bit by like Trayvon Martin, but a lot of the deaths of black men and women, black people at the hands of police and systemic racism. And the idea that you're always the guy they're looking for. You're always the suspect. Yeah. And like using that hoodie imagery. And then when you look at the film posters, I'm like, oh gosh, it really reminds me of that. A lot of the artwork around Trayvon Martin and the hoodie.
Sure. Yeah.
So again, there's like imagery there, but it's not really commented on, but it's in the film that I really appreciated about this. So I like this. I agree. This is something that I would show. I thought it was fun, but also deep. I agree. It got a little, they're trying to work with 90 some minutes. I actually think this film would have been better longer, maybe, just because one, I would have liked to have seen more of of Vicaria's relationship with her brother, with Chris, and wanting to know more on that side, only because it would clarify, because she talks about how they've made him a monster with their response to him, but she also is afraid of him because she doesn't know what his intentions are. And then in the end, is he going to kill her too? Because he's killed his girlfriend who was carrying his baby. I believe that was what we were supposed to take from that, right? That it was his child. So he murders her mother, murders
the brother,
Vicaria's father. Yeah, the brother, all everybody. So it's, you don't really know if he's reacting because he's scared and terrified and people are terrified of him. So it's that Frankenstein thing, right? Yeah. Which I couldn't believe little Jada made it out, because I was like, oh, she's going to be the little girl with the flowers.
Yeah.
You know, she's all like being friendly with him and stuff. I'm like, oh, when is she going to show up somewhere, you know?
But the first kind of like innocent that he kills is actually his father, who in many ways.
Right.
It's such an interesting choice to have the father show up the way that that particular portrayal. Chad Coleman, right? Is that his name?
Yes, as Donald.
Yes, as Donald. So Chad Coleman, who folks may know from The Walking Dead as Tyrese, basically reprising a lot of Tyrese in this. I just felt like I was watching Tyrese in this, but like that being the choice, because I was like, oh, Jada's done. But she also was a creepy fucking kid. I liked her a lot, but it was really unsettling when she was like, maybe he's behind you. No. But yeah, I just thought it was a good choice.
But she obviously wasn't responding to him with fear. So they formed like a friendship that you also don't see. I would have liked to have seen that as well, a little bit more. I like the way they introduced it. You know, that she was talking to him and we hadn't seen that, but I would have liked to have seen some more scenes between them. Cause that's part of that evidence of he is responding to other people's fear of him, which again is very Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster. That's always one of those kind of conversations about who the monster is, right? Even though he's killing people, is he doing it because he wants to, or is it response? Yeah. And again, I guess it's just because the dad like reacts so badly to him. It's sad. That's the other thing about this movie. It's fun. It has some like comical elements. It's got a lot of gore obviously going on. Fun gore. She like pulls like a tendon out or whatever. It's like wiggling, looking at it. I enjoy all that when she's like working on him. But there's also this like real sadness underneath it. You're dealing with people whose lives have been irrevocably changed because of violence, systemic issues from lots of different ways, and trying to make the best of it. At least she is. She obviously wants to, well, I mean, again, if she's curing death, that's how you change the whole world. But there and the question is, actually, there was a quote that I liked that was this was the harrowing take on the Frankenstein tale in the film. One of the of life's greatest wounds is death, and the subsequent grief that follows it. It's a steep price we pay for the honor of communing and sharing our soul with another living being. Their absence forces us to accept and acclimate to a new version of normal, one with a landmine of triggers that can slice our emotional flesh at any given moment. What if death itself were a disease that could be cured? Would we want the antidote, even if it came with bloody ramifications? And this says, this is the crux of Bomani. I think I'm saying that. J Story's horror drama, The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster, and a oft bleak, there's that word, love that word.
Secret word.
Bleak meditation on systemic oppression and violence, heartbreak, and death. And of course, that always gets me thinking about like kind of, you know, the work I do, those first sentences are something I inevitably, you know, is part of like my introduction in my grief group that I do. And it's that, you know, we can't cure death. We can't cure grief. Would we want to? We're supposed to feel loss because it deepens love. It deepens commitment. It deepens our experience as humans. And so if you knew that you, like, what's the point of anything if we lived forever? Or if we could, or if we could bring the dead back. So, of course, even in this film, obviously, it's not. Well, I guess that's where it gets muddled again at the end. So we'll have to talk about that. But at least in the first part, it's the same. It's you brought him back and it definitely did not solve the problem.
No, you know, created more.
Yeah. And it's just, is Chris, this isn't an ideal living situation for somebody.
Yeah. Like, they don't really, you're right in that I would have loved to see more flashbacks with Chris as Chris, not as the creature. Because I think there would have been some connection, because in reflecting on it now, it really is just there. Chris just functions as a way for Vicaria to realize her own research and solve her hypothesis.
Right.
But
with that having to be burdened by thinking of the consequences.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, again, it's like this magic thing. I did love that we still get daddy issues, because there was daddy issues in the original Frankenstein movie, and then there's daddy issues here. And what was also interesting about this film was, I expected Chris to have been killed by the police, and for there to be some sort of, I was expecting some sort of revenge kind of wish fulfillment against the police. And then to see Tango and the gang be like the major bads of this film was really fascinating, because that's not where I thought they were going to go with it. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that with Aisha, they're trying to introduce, with Aisha, it's just there, our people are our people, and we need to try to do our best to protect ourselves with her. What does her mom call her? Hotepin. Her mom says,
"You're Hotepin." That was pretty funny as well. Yeah, trying to bring in Black history and talk about what's hidden and what's not taught in schools. Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. And again, it does, when you have a Black man writing this story, obviously he could go that direction. Mm-hmm. He could make this about the police. But there is a comment. And that's part of it, obviously, when the school weaponizes security against Vicaria, the white teacher who just doesn't like what this kid is saying to her. She can weaponize state-sanctioned violence, basically, against her. Yeah. So that comment is there, and there are police on part of it. One of them is murdered, but I think we think it's Chris that murdered him, but in the end, it's the other gang member, Jamal, I think, who killed the police officer, or at least brags about killing a police officer. We're not shown. But Vicaria thinks it's Chris. So I feel like you get both. So you get this idea that, yes, systemic racism is operating in the violence against bodies of color, but particularly against Black bodies. Mm-hmm. But there's also other parts of our world where we're hurting each other and we're participating in certain kinds of violence against each other. And again, that's something that is present, I think, in all of that is how oppression operates the most effectively, is to internalize it and then to play out certain things. And we see that obviously all the time in the LGBTQIA2+, where there's these sort of identity politics that get it played about who has a right to be considered a part of the group and who doesn't. And we enact a lot of patriarchal and misogynist bullshit against each other. And so I identify with, that's one of the reasons I like this story, because it's like it's coming at this from a lot of angles. It's showing like her mother died. I think it's like a stray bullet. It's not like she was purposely killed, but this is the neighborhood they're living in. This is what happened, or wherever they were at. And so the dad's like working two jobs. He's trying to like keep the family together. And this is the ways that something can break down, where it's not like nobody's like flawed, right? It's not some fault of their personhood. They're trying to do their best to live and survive, and this is the world that they're operating in. So I really appreciate it. This was a little bit more nuanced than just the kind of similar to Get Out, right? Get Out had this conversation going on that it's not really just about police violence. It's about other things. And so I think this did a good job of covering in the nuanced way. But again, at the end, it gets confusing, because I go back to the end where they decide she's got to kill Chris. This isn't good. It's not right to have him having to live this way in this body. Plus, obviously, he's dangerous at times. So she decides to kill him. But then they discover that he's murdered these other people. And so she like brings them back to life, and they're like just themselves again. We don't know. It ends there. But I feel like that kind of muddied like what the point of the film was.
Yeah. It was like
it didn't work with him. Let's just try it with something else. You know,
it didn't work with him because he wasn't fresh. Like when she's
bringing back fresh bodies.
Yeah. So is she going to bring back her dad? Like how are we going to, what's happening next? And It's also that thing, right, of we need black women to save us, right? Like, black women are out here trying to save all of us. I love the kind of twist on a callback to the original film when Aisha realizes that her baby's alive and she's like, he's alive. I thought that was really cool. I was like, love that.
I'm glad that she resurrected them for the story, just for but I was just like, wow, what's the lesson in that part of it? Because obviously a lot of times when we see these movies, Frankenstein movies, it's usually like wealthy men playing God. That's the story, right? And what happens when you play God or when you go against the laws of nature, like you suffer and pay for it. And so this film, it just gets a little muddy in there because she's a 17-year-old girl dealing with all of this violence and awful stuff. And oh gosh, I have the secret to life itself, but it goes wrong and it kills a lot of people that she knows and loves and cares about. And so I just don't know, would have been a better story to have left them dead, and it's just like her and Jada at the end trying to make sense of it. But that's not right either. I don't want poor little Jada to be without her family.
It left me
with a lot of weird thoughts at the end. I'm not sure how to take this.
Yeah. Is the moral of the story that we just need to listen to black women and fund their research?
Yeah, because then maybe then it would have been she would have succeeded where Victor Frankenstein failed.
Yes, exactly. Like you said, it's so interesting that that's the message that you're leaving the film with, right? Is that that she is right. And not that she's right, but that she has managed to find a way to subvert or to introduce new concepts of reality. In that, what if death was not the end? What if, and then realizing, okay, we're not meant to live forever.
Right.
Right. And if death is a disease, but what is that? It doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense, but there's more questions. And I think that's part of the appeal of the film, is that you get to ask this. And Joshua, like you, I really love that you brought up your work and what you're doing, especially around grief and things. And what do you feel is the answer in terms of, if death were a disease, could we cure it? Like, what is the space for grief? How does grief and that kind of love manifest in the absence of death?
I guess that's a point. It wouldn't. If you knew nobody was ever going to die or be lost, it would take away some of the immediacy of these sorts of feelings. The pressure of them would go away. Like I said, I would love to live forever.
Yeah.
I don't know if all of us should live forever. The planet, I don't know if that could take it. So there are bigger existential questions here that would have to be considered, just about the practicalities of being an immortal. We've discussed this before. But yeah, so instead I work very hard I work with people to help them do the work of like radical acceptance of loss and seeing that part of grief, that it's grief isn't just sadness. It contains a lot of joy as well, because it contains memory, which can be joyful and loving. And we learn a lot from people in our lives and in our losses. So I don't know if that answers the question. I don't know if there is a good answer.
I'd ask a question that really has nothing
with group therapy.
Yeah, that really has nothing to do with the film, but I'm just very curious, since we're talking about grief. How do you, I have a friend who is right now dealing with grief with a family member from their immediate family who passed a couple years ago. But prior to that, they had no relationship with them, no relationship for 10 years. And it's been interesting hearing them talk about their process of grief and things, when it's hearing grief is love hanging on, right? Grief is love hanging on. But what about when you don't? What about when how do you grieve somebody who you had no real love or relationship with? But the absence is like, it's, you're grieving something that never existed.
Yeah. No, and that's a big part of it too. Again, with what we're talking about because of this particular film, it's her love of her mother and her love of her brother, that it's, this is enough death around me. I'm going to solve this problem for myself. And so I'm going to bring them back. I'm going to figure out the answers to life so that I can avoid this pain. So in that response, that is like one kind of grief, is the love of it all. But yeah, no, there's always a lot of if in grief, this gigantic word, biggest word in our language, if. That is very hard for people, especially because a lot of it becomes more about what should I have done? And it becomes more of a very negative self-talk. I should have done this or that. And again, it's one of those things where it's, we have to accept the situation as they, as it is. It's like, I've talked to, with people about this. When my mother was still alive, there was a time in our life where I didn't talk to her for 2 years because she needed to get her shit together. And even if I want to think that even if I had known how short of time we actually would have had together, I still would have chosen to do that because it was necessary. And so I don't spend time thinking like, oh man, I should have used those 2 years better. But it's not, because I used them the way that I knew then the information that I had to use them. And it's the same with people. It's like it is a kind of radical acceptance as well of, oh, did I waste 10 years not talking to this person? So you made the choices you made with the information that you had. And I think it's better to try to be self-compassionate because we can't change the past.
What happened?
And so it sucks. Again, that's also one of those things where I hold a lot of space for just the sucks of it all. Like, that fucking sucks. It sucks if you miss or wish that you had been able to do this or that, or you lose somebody really unexpectedly who you maybe had a fight with, right? Because we're magical creatures of magical thinking sometimes. And then we go, well, what if I hadn't had that fight with them? Maybe they'd still be alive. And it's, I don't know who has that kind of power. So that's kind of part of it. Moving a little over from this, because there was actually something really, a really good conversation in here that I really appreciated that they gave to, like, the bad guy in this. We have Chris, the monster, fine. But Kengo is also the other villain, right? He's like the gang leader and the one pushing everybody in his neighborhood. He's the person a lot of people are he's forcing her to be involved in his drugs. He gave drugs to the father. I bet, like, Chris, when Chris's mother died and then his dad was at work all the time, working two jobs, and he was out there trying to figure out how to be in the world. There's Kengo, right? You can be in the gang and we'll take care of you. But his little speech about how addiction is emotional, like an emotional issue. And he talks about how if there were more mental health clinics here, I'd be in a different business. And I was like, whoo, that was a nice couple of lines that really also highlight the whole, this whole film. It just turns it a little bit. And I just thought that was really great. He's like, you know, people are out here, you know, trying to survive, and I offer them a way to deal. Which is, in my limited experience that I've had so far, you know, a lot of my clients I've mentioned before, you know, are co-occurring. So they have substance use disorders along with, or diagnoses of substance use disorders and mental health disorders. And a lot of times, people turn to whatever they can to deal. And if we were providing more, if we were putting more money, taxing the rich, and taking that money and putting it into healthcare and putting it into mental health and all that, a lot of these things, I do truly believe that is a path forward. Compassionate responses to these issues. Because again, I don't buy this idea that humans are naturally selfish monsters, as much as I love movies about that and horror kind of reflecting the monstrousness of us. But I think people who know that they have housing and know that they have food and water and access to the things that they need to survive I guess we won't know until we see everybody have that sort of experience. But I think that's the answer, is providing more of those kinds of spaces. And we do have some information because we know other countries that approach things differently, or we approach, if we make a change of when decriminalization effort, it does have transformative effect on people's lives in a positive way.
Yeah.
So that little moment between them of, you're ruining our neighborhood, and he's saying, I'm taking advantage of the situation. I didn't create this, and I'm actually helping people by providing this service. I like that. So this is from another article review. Denzel Whitaker adds a dash of magnetism to the role of Kengo, the neighborhood drug dealer. And talking about drugs as an emotional issue, and he is providing a cure. He's fixing people's heartache. And so this yeah, their banter, Vicaria and Kengo, provides this space to think about the big, these bigger existential issues that are being discussed in the film. And I just, I really appreciated that part. Let's see. I think that pretty much hits on the things I wanted to cover. Again, I really like this movie. I thought it was fun. I would definitely show it. I like that idea. Show it at a party with something. Little Friday night movie night.
Little Friday night movie night.
And because I do think that it even it's fun, it's gory, it's freaky. There are some, I think, some really nice tense scenes in it. The lighting is really cool. Mm-hmm. There's some really nice work being done there.
Real good use of screaming. Like, yeah, that kind of took me aback by how, like, I was affected by it, like, especially in that second half.
Yeah, yeah. And there was just some really nice, I mean, again, I'm not really big into, like, you know, what's good or bad camera work. I don't know, director stuff. But early in the film, there's like this beautiful scene of, I don't know, it was like grass, but weeds or something like blowing in the wind, and then like blood, like slowly like splattering over them. It was just this really beautifully composed moment, you know, of this person's death in this, I don't know. It was just, there was just something about it. That image is staying in my head. So there's just some really nice things going on here. Again, I wish that it was maybe had an extra 20 minutes to further explore some of the relationships. I would have liked to, I think, I don't know. I don't know what to do about the ending, mm-hmm. but I just feel conflicted about it, but it was still fun. And I totally worth a watch, and I would watch it again. For sure.
One thing that you reminded me of was this movie from 2019. I think it was a Netflix. It's on Netflix. It's See You Yesterday. Which is about two black youth in STEM that basically create these backpacks that go back in time. And they've been trying to create these backpacks that go back in time. And then they're urged to finish their research and as a way to prevent one of their older siblings from being gunned down by the police. So this is an interesting, again, sometimes we talk about pairing movies, right? Doing a See You Yesterday, The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster double feature, because essentially they're trying to do the same thing, but they're also taking into account like two also very old ideas, old tropes of culture and literature, time travel, time machine, and then the Frankenstein narrative.
So that, the one that, what was it called again?
See You Yesterday.
See You Yesterday. Is that horror or is it more just sci-fi?
It's more sci-fi. Okay. I would probably put it in real world horror because I remember watching it in 2020 as part of trying to watch more black stories, and that I think that's when it got a lot of its play too, was in 2020 when those lists were coming out about black stories to watch. And I remember it being like really interesting and effective, being like, okay, what if time travel could solve it? And I won't spoil it for those who have not seen it, because it's definitely worth a watch, but the ending is also troubling as well. Like it's and I think that's also part of the point, right? Not to sound formulaic, the ending thought with this film, with Angry Black Girl and Her Monster, is just kind of, she's right, but like, where do we go from here, right? Yeah. If it didn't stop her from doing what she did, it only just, she knows now what she needs to do to be more successful at it. So it's not that it doesn't even like question whether or not she was like, we're still asking whether or not it was wrong for her to raise the dead. But now we're just asking, now we're just being even more granular with it. At what point is it wrong? If you've not raised them within the first 24 hours, what's the what are the limitations of resurrection?
I was just looking, there was an Ending Explain article I just saw, but it's about this person interpreting it because she saves Aisha and the baby. Metaphor for how violence and prejudice against people attempt to blur the road ahead in hopes that they'll never find the way to excel. As long as the Vicarias of the world don't stop dreaming, evil hasn't won the war. So, I mean, yeah, I get that. I get the idea of, you know, it says it ends with what is a flicker of hope in a black hole of pain and chaos. And yeah, so just trying to have some hope for the future. So it isn't just accepting that everybody's dead and that this is just what her life is going to be. She can envision and she has the tools to improve it. So that's, I definitely get that messaging in there. It's just with the rest of the film, because of everything happening. And then you have the Frankenstein mythos, which was all that. Again, they don't have to like stick with that trope and that conversation. And they're using the language of Frankenstein to tell a new story. So, yeah. Either way, again, I still enjoyed it enough. It wasn't, the ending wasn't so bad. It was just, I was like, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to feel about her, about her character and everybody and everything that's happened. If you could just bring these people back, despite it not going right with Chris. But again, that's also explained because he's made up of a lot of other, she's body snatching. So whatever. It's good.
She's body snatching. She'd be Grave Robin.
Yeah. And it's good to be able to sit back and just be like, well, I've got things to think about in this movie. It didn't wrap up evenly, so that's okay. Or, you know, in a bow. All right. Well, that was The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster. And that wraps up our February on Fright School. I did want to promote there is a new edition. The second edition of Horror Noir is out. Very cool with this Candyman cover. It includes, I think, some expanded chapters on the 60s and the 2000s. Along with just general what they do when they update books. I'm working my way through it now. Unfortunately, it did not get edited early enough to include this film, but there's still lots of good conversation in there. I also want to just keep promoting Queer for Fear, Horror Film and the Queer Spectator. I finally got my copy.
Yay.
So I'm working my way through that as well. And I really hope Heather Opetricelli shows up here in the future again. We've had her on in the past. I would love to be fun to have her on. But yeah, so there we go. Happy.
Love it.
Books. I'm always happy when I have books, new books to read. Or new old books even. Whatever. As long as there's books.
Yes.
All right, Joe. Thank you as always. Thank you, dear listener. And good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.